Hello, everyone. The following is a bonus episode featured on Sleep and Relax ASMR and Friends originally. The reason why I am featuring it on the regular podcast is because I had a few listeners request this type of episode a couple weeks back. And, I don't want you to miss this episode if you were one of the few that requested something like this. Now, for those of you unfamiliar, Sleep and Relax ASMR and Friends is a second podcast I started. It's going to feature bonus episodes from Sleep and Relax ASMR, and it will feature content from other independent, very talented ASMR content creators. So, didn't want you to miss this particular episode, since I did get a few requests. But if you're looking for more content and, different ASMR, make sure to check out Sleep and Relax ASMR and Friends. You'll find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Podcast. You'll find it basically everywhere you'll find Sleep and Relax ASMR. So, either way, enjoy this bonus episode, and thanks for listening. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Sleep and Relax ASMR. This episode, I'm whispering the Wikipedia page for the Parliament of 1327. This is a series we call ASM Articles. Basically, we pick a person, place, event, whatever it may be, and we learn about it together by reading the Wikipedia page. So hopefully we learn something new, and in the process, after you learn something useful, maybe, probably not, then you fall asleep or relax. It's whatever you need it to do for you. Oops, sorry. So, with that in mind, let's get on with the Parliament of 1327. Of 1327, which sat at the Palace of Westminster between January 7th and March 9th, 1327, was instrumental in the transfer of the English crown from King Edward II to his son, Edward III, previously Earl of Chester. Edward II had become increasingly unpopular with the English nobility, predominantly because of the excessive influence of unpopular court favorites, the patronage he devoted to them, and his perceived ill treatment of the nobility. By 1325, even his wife Isabella despised him. Toward the end of the year, she took their son, the Earl of Chester, to France, where she joined and probably entered into a relationship with a powerful and wealthy nobleman, Roger Mortimer, whom her husband had exiled. The following year, they invaded England to depose Edward II. Almost immediately, the king's resistance was beset by betrayal, and he eventually abandoned London and fled west, probably to raise an army in Wales or Ireland. He was soon captured and imprisoned. Isabella and Mortimer summoned a parliament to confer legitimacy, their regime. The meeting began gathering at Westminster on 7th of January, but little could be done in the absence of the king. The 14-year-old Earl of Chester was proclaimed keeper of the realm, but not yet king. And as a parliamentary deputation was sent to Edward II asking him to allow himself to be brought to Parliament, he refused and the Parliament continued without him. The king was accused of offenses ranging from the promotion of favorites to the destruction of the church, resulting in a betrayal of his coronation oath to the people. These were known as the Articles of Accusation. The city of London was particularly aggressive in its attacks on
22nd, and its citizens may have helped intimidate those attending Parliament into agreeing to the King's deposition, which occurred on the afternoon of January 13th. On or around January 21st, the Lords Temporal sent another delegation to the King to inform him of his deposition, effectively giving Edward an ultimatum. If he did not agree to hand over the crown to his son, then the lords and Parliament would give it to somebody outside the royal family. King Edward wept, but agreed to their conditions. The delegation returned to London, and Edward II's son was proclaimed King Edward III immediately. He was crowned on February 1st, 1327. In the aftermath of the parliamentary session, his father remained in prison, being moved around to prevent attempted rescues. He died, presumed killed, in September the same year, probably on Mortimer's orders. Crises continued for Mortimer and Isabella, who were de facto rulers of the country, partly because of Mortimer's own greed, mismanagement, and mishandling of the new king. Edward III led a coup d'etat against Mortimer in 1330, overthrew him, and began his personal rule. Background. King Edward II of England had court favorites who were unpopular with his nobility, such as Piers Gaveston and Hugh Despenser the Younger. Gaveston was killed during an earlier noble rebellion against Edward in 1312, and Despenser was hated by the English nobility. Edward was also unpopular with the common people due to his repeated demands from them for unpaid military service in Scotland. None of his campaigns there were successful, and this led to a further decline in his popularity, particularly with the nobility. His image was further diminished in 1322 when he executed his cousin Thomas, Earl of Lancaster, and confiscated the Lancaster estates. Historian Chris Gibbon Wilson has written how, by 1325, the nobility believed that, quote, no landholder could feel safe, quote, under the regime. The distrust of Edward was shared by his wife, Queen Isabella, who believed Despenser responsible for poisoning the king's mind against her. In September 1324, she had been publicly humiliated when the government declared her an enemy alien, and the king had immediately repossessed her estates, probably at the urging of Despenser. Edward also disbanded her retinue. Edward had already been threatened with deposition on two previous occasions, in 1312 and 1321. Historians agree that hostility towards Edward was universal. W.H. Dunham and C.T. Wood ascribe this to Edward's cruelty and personal faults, suggesting that very few, not even his half-brothers or his son, seemed to care about the wretched man, and that none would fight for him. A contemporary chronicler described Edward as Rex Inutilus, or as a useless king. France had recently invaded the Duchy of Aquitaine. I don't know how to say that. D-U-C-H-Y. Duché of Aquitaine. Then in English royal possession. In response, King Edward sent Isabella to Paris, accompanied by their 13-year-old son, Edward, Earl of Chester, to negotiate a settlement. Contemporaries believed that she had sworn, on leaving, never to return to England with the Despensers in power. Soon after her arrival, correspondence between Isabella and her husband, as well as between them, the French King, Charles the Fourth, and the Pope effectively disclosed the royal couple's increasing estrangement to the world. Estrangement. A contemporary chronicler reports how Isabella and Edward became increasingly scathing of each other, worsening relations. By December 1325, she had entered into a possibly sexual relationship in Paris with the wealthy exiled nobleman Roger Mortimer. This was public knowledge in England by March 1326, and the king openly considered a divorce. He demanded that Isabella and Edward return to England, which they refused to do. She sent, quote, she sent back many of her retinue, but gave trivial excuses for not returning herself, end quote, noted her biographer, John Parsons. Prince Edward's failure to break with his mother angered the king further. Isabella became more strident in her criticism of Edward's government, particularly against Walter de Stapleton, Bishop of Exeter, a close associate of the king and dispenser. King Edward alienated his son by putting the prince's estates under royal administration in January 1326, and the following month the king ordered that both the prince and his mother be arrested on landing in England. While in Paris, the queen became the head of King Edward's exiled opposition. Along with Mortimer, this group included Edmund of Woodstock, Earl of Kent, Henry de Beaumont, John de Boutold, John Maltravers, and William Trussell. All were united by hatred of the dispensers. Isabella betrayed her and Prince Edward as seeking refuge from her husband and his court, both of whom she claimed were hostile to her and claimed protection from Edward II. King Charles refused to countenance an invasion of England. Instead, the rebels gained the court of Hainaut's backing. In return, Isabella agreed that the prince would marry the count's daughter, Philippa of Hainaut. This was a further insult to the English king, who had intended to use his eldest son's marriage as a bargaining tool against France, probably intending a marriage alliance with Spain. Invasion of England. From February 1326, it was clear in England that Isabella and Mortimer intended to invade. Despite false alarms, large ships, as a defensive measure, were forbidden from leaving English ports, and some were pressed into royal service. King Edward declared war on France in July. Isabella and Mortimer invaded England in September, landing in Suffolk on the 24th. The commander of the royal fleet assisted the rebels. The first of many betrayals Edward II suffered. Isabella and Mortimer soon found they had significant support among the English political class. They were quickly joined by Thomas, Earl of Norfolk, the king's brother, accompanied by Henry, Earl of Leicester, brother of the executed Earl of Lancaster, and soon afterwards arrived the Archbishop of Canterbury and Bishops of Hereford and Lincoln. Within the week, support for the king had dissolved, and, accompanied by Despenser, he deserted London and traveled west. Edward's fight to the west precipitated his downfall. Historian Michael Prestwich describes the king's support as collapsing like a building hit by an earthquake. Edward's rule was already weak, and even before the invasion, along with preparation, there had been panic. Now there was simply panic. Amrod notes how, given that Mortimer and his adherents were already condemned traitors, and that any engagement with the invading force was to be treated as an act of open rebellion, it is all the more striking how many great men were prepared to enter upon such a high-risk venture at such an early stage in its persecution. In this respect, at least the presence of the heir to the throne in the queen's entourage may have proved decisive. King Edward's attempt to raise an army in South Wales was to no avail, and he and Spencer were captured on November 16, 1326, near Lanstrasand. This, along with the unexpected swiftness with which his entire regime had collapsed, forced Isabella Mortimer to wield wield executive power. Not weird, wield executive power until they made arrangements for a successor to the throne. The king was incarcerated by the Earl of Leicester, while those suspected of being dispenser spies or supporters of the king, particularly in London, which was aggressively loyal to the queen, were murdered by mobs. Isabella spent the last months of 1326 in the West Country, and while in Bristol witnessed the hanging of Despenser's father, the Earl of Winchester, on October 27th. Despenser himself was captured in Hereford and executed there within the month. In Bristol, Isabella, Mortimer, and the accompanying lords discussed strategy. Not yet possessing the Great Seal, on October 26th they proclaimed Edward, Earl of Chester, as guardian of the realm, declaring that, by the assent of the whole community of the said kingdom present there, they unanimously chose Edward III as keeper of said kingdom. He was not yet officially declared king. The rebels' description of themselves as a community deliberately harked back to the reform movement of Simon de Montfort and the Baronial League, which had described its reform program as being of the community of the realm against Henry III. Claire Valente has pointed out how, in reality, the most common phrase heard was not the community of the realm, but the quarrel of the Earl of Lancaster, illustrating how the struggle was still a factional one with baronial politics, whatever cloak it may have appeared to possess as a reform movement. By November 20th, 1326, the Bishop of Hereford had retrieved the Great Seal from the king and delivered it to Prince Edward. He can now be announced as his father's heir apparent, although at this stage it might have still been possible for Edward II to remain king. Says Amrod, the writing was on the wall. A document issued by Isabella and her son at this time described their respective positions. Thus, Isabel, by the grace of God, Queen of England, Lady of Ireland, Countess of Ponthieu, and we, Edward, eldest son of the noble king, England, Edward of England, Duke of Gascony, Earl of Chester, of Ponthieu, of Montreal, DNA SC 13746. Summoning of Parliament. Isabella, Mortimer, and the lords arrived in London on January 4th, 1327. In response to the previous year's spate of murders, Londoners have been forbidden to bear arms, and 2 days later, all citizens have sworn an oath to keep the peace. Parliament met on January 7th to consider the state of the realm. Now the king was incarcerated. It had originally been summoned by Isabella and the prince in the name of the king on October 28th, the previous year. Parliament had been intended to assemble on December 14th, 1326, but on December 3rd, still in the name of the king, further writs were issued deferring the sitting until early the next year. This, it was implied, was due to the king being abroad rather than imprisoned. Because of this, Parliament would have to be held before the Queen and Prince Edward. The history of Parliament Trust has described this legality of the writs as being highly questionable, and C.T. Wood called the sitting a show of pseudo-parliamentary regularity, stage-managed by Mortimer and Thomas, Lord Wake. For Isabella and Mortimer, governing through Parliament was only a temporary solution to a constitutional problem, because at some point their position would likely be challenged legally. Thus, suggests Ormrod, they had to enforce a solution favorable to Mortimer and the Queen by any means that they could. were uncertain as to the legality of Isabella's parliament. Edward II was still king, although in official documents this was only with alongside his most beloved consort, Isabella, Queen of England, and his firstborn son, Keeper of the Kingdom, in what Phil Bradford called as a nominal presidency. King Edward was said to be abroad when in reality he was imprisoned in Kenilworth Castle. It was maintained that he desired a colloquium and a tractatum conference and consultation. Sorry, I keep clicking here accidentally. Sorry if you can hear that. Conference and consultation with his lords upon various affairs, touching himself and the estate of the kingdom. Hence the holding of parliament. Supposedly it was Edward II himself who postponed the first sitting until January for certain necessary causes and utilities, presumably at the behest of the Queen and Mortimer. A priority for the new regime was deciding what to do with Edward II. Mortimer considered holding a state trial for treason, in the expectation of a guilty verdict and a death sentence. He and other lords discussed the matter at Isabella's Wallingford Castle, just after Christmas, but with no agreement. The lords temporal affirmed that Edward had failed his country so gravely that only his death could heal it. The attending bishops, on the other hand, held that whatever his faults, he had been anointed king by God. This presented Isabella and Mortimer with two problems. First, the bishops' arguments would be popularly understood as risking the wrath of God. Second, public trials always bring the danger of an unintended verdict, particularly as it seems like a broad body of public opinion doubted whether an anointed king could even commit treason. Such a result would mean not only Edward's release, but his restoration to the throne. Mortimer and Isabella sought to avoid a trial, and yet keep Edward II imprisoned for life. The king's imprisonment, officially by his son, had become public knowledge, and Isabella and Mortimer's hand was forced, as the arguments for Prince Edward being named Keeper of the Kingdom were now groundless, as the king had clearly returned to his realm one way or another. Attendance. No parliament had sat since November 1325. Only 26 of the 46 barons who had been summoned in October 1326 for the December parliament were then also summoned to that of January 1327, and six of those had never received summons under Edward II at all. Officially, the instigators of the parliament were the bishops of Hereford and Winchester, Roger Mortimer, and Thomas Wake. Isabella almost certainly played a background role. They summoned as Lords Spiritual the Archbishop of Canterbury and 15 English and 4 Welsh bishops, as well as 19 abbots. The Lords Temporal were represented by the Earls of Norfolk, Kent, Lancaster, Surrey, Oxford, Athol, and Hereford. 47 barons, 23 royal justices, and several knights and burgesses were summoned from the shires. They may well have been encouraged, suggests Medicott, by the wages to be paid to those attending, the handsome sum of 4 shillings a day for a knight and 2 for a burgess. Although a radical gathering, the parliament was to some degree consistent with previous assemblies, being dominated by lords reliant on a support of commons. It differed, though, in the greater than usual influence that outsiders and commoners had, such as those from London. The January through February parliament was geographically broader too, as it contained unelected members from Bury, St. Edmunds, and St. Albans, says Medicott. Those who planned the deposition, speech down in Parliament to those who had no right to be there. And, says Dot, the rebels deliberately made Parliament center stage to their plans. Parliament assembled. The king's absence. Before Parliament met, the lords had sent Adam Orleton, Bishop of Hereford, and William Trussell Kenilworth to see the king, with the intention of persuading Edward to return with them and attend Parliament. They failed in the mission. Edward flatly refused and roundly cursed them. The envoys returned to Westminster on January 12th, by which time Parliament had been sitting 5 days. It was felt that nothing could be done until the king had arrived. Historically, Parliament could only pass statutes with the monarch present. Edward II's refusal to attend failed to prevent the Parliament from taking place, the first time this had ever happened. Constitutional crisis. The various titles bestowed on the younger Edward at the end of 1326, which acknowledged his unique position in government while avoiding calling him king, reflected an underlying constitutional crisis of which contemporaries were keenly aware. The fundamental question was how the crown was transferred between two living kings, a situation which had never arisen before. Valente has described how this upset the accepted order of things, threatened the sacrosanctity of kingship, and lacked clear legality or established process. Contemporaries were also uncertain as to whether Edward II had abdicated or was being deposed. On October 26, it had been recorded in the close rolls that Edward had left or abandoned his kingdom, and his absence enabled Isabella and Mortimer to rule. They could legitimately argue, that King Edward, having provided no regent during his absence, as would be usual, should make his son governor of the kingdom in his father's stead. They also said Edward II held Parliament in contempt by calling it a treasonous assembly, and insulted those attending it as traitors. It is unknown whether the king did, in fact, say or believe this, but it certainly suited Isabella and Mortimer for Parliament to think so. Proceedings of Monday, January 12th. Parliament had to consider its next step. Bishop Orleton, emphasizing Isabella's fear of the king, asked the assembled lords whom they would prefer to rule, Edward or his son. The response was sluggish, with no rush to either depose or acclaim. Deposition had been raised too suddenly for many members to stomach. The king was still not entirely friendless, and indeed had been described by Paul Driber as casting an ominous shadow over the proceedings. Proceedings on January 13th, Tuesday. Whether Edward II resigned his throne or was forced from it under pressure, the crown legally changed hands on January 13th with the support, it was recorded, of all the baronage of the land. Parliament met in the morning and then suspended itself. A large group of the lords temporal and spiritual made their way to the city of London's Guildhall, where they swore an oath to uphold all that had been ordained or shall be ordained for the common profit. The group then returned to Westminster in the afternoon, and the lords formally acknowledged that Edward II was no longer to be king. Several orations were made. Mortimer, speaking on behalf of the lords, announced their decision. Edward II, he proclaimed, would abdicate, and Sir Edward should have the government of the realm and be crowned king. Articles of accusation. During the sermons, the articles of deposition were officially presented to the assembly, in contrast to the elaborate and floridly hyperbolic accusations previously launched at the dispensers. This was a relatively simple document. The king was accused of being incapable of fair rule, of indulging false counselors, preferring his own amusements to good government, neglecting England and losing Scotland, dilapidating the church and imprisoning the clergy, and all in all being in fundamental breach of the coronation oath he had made to his subjects, all of which the rebels claimed was so well known as to be undeniable. The articles accuse Edward's favorites of tyranny, although not the king himself, whom they described as incorrigible, without the hope of reform. The king deposed every speaker on January 13th, reiterated the articles of accusation, and all concluded by offering Prince Edward as king if the people approved him. The crowd outside, which included a large company of unruly Londoners, says Valente, had been whipped into such fervor by dramatic outcries at appropriate points in the orations from Thomas Wake, who repeatedly rose and demanded the assembly whether they agree with each speaker. Do you agree? Do the people of the country agree? Wake's exhortations, arms outstretched, says Prestwich, he cried, I see for myself that he shall reign no more. Combined with the intimidating mob led to tumultuous responses of let it be done, let it be done. Edward III was proclaimed king. At the end of the day, said Valente, the Electio of the Magnates received the acclamatio of populi fiat. Proceedings drew to a close with a chorus of gloria, laus et honor, and perhaps oaths of homage for the lords to the new king. The king's response. One final action remained to be taken. The ex-king in Kenilworth had to be informed that his subjects had chosen to withdraw their allegiance from him. A delegation was organized to take the news. The delegates were the Bishop of Ely, Hereford, and London, and around 30 laymen. It was not composed solely of parliamentarians, but there were enough of them in it to appear parliamentarian. Its size had also been added advantage of spreading collective responsibility far more broadly than would have happened in a small group. They left on or shortly after Thursday, January 15th, and arrived in Kenilworth by either January 21st or 22nd, when William Trussell asked for the king to be brought to them in the name of Parliament. Edward, dressed in a black gown and under the Earl of Lancaster's escort, was brought to the Great Hall. Geoffrey Baker's chronicle describes how the delegates equivocated at first, adulterating the word of truth before coming to the point. Edward was afforded the choice of resigning in favor of the Earl of Chester and being provided for according his rank, or of being deposed. This, it was emphasized, could lead to the throne being offered to someone not of royal blood, but politically experienced, clearly referring to Mortimer. The king protested mildly and wept, fainting at one point. According to Worldon's later report, Edward claimed he had always followed the guidance of his nobles, but regretted any harm he had done. The delegation left Kenilworth for London on January 22nd. Their news preceded them. By the time they reached Westminster, around January 25th, Edward III was already officially referred to as king, and his peace had been proclaimed at St. Paul's Cathedral on the 24th. Edward III's reign was thus dated from January 25th, 1327. Behind the scenes, though, discussions must have begun on the thorny question of what to do with his predecessor, who still had not had any judgment, legal or parliamentary, passed upon him. Subsequent events and aftermath. Edward, Earl of Chester's political education was deliberately accelerated by the tutelage of advisors such as William of Pegula and Walter de Millamont. Still a minor, Edward III was crowned at Westminster Abbey on February 1st, 1327. Isabella gained an annual income of 20,000. 1,000 marks. 13,333 euros or pounds. I guess pounds or quid. I don't really know the European currency. She achieved this by requesting the return of her dower, which her husband had confiscated. It was returned to her substantially augmented. Let's see here. Because I didn't totally copy and paste this. Okay. When recalled, Parliament returned to its usual business and heard a large number, 42, of petitions from their community. These not only included the political and often lengthy petitions related directly to the deposition, but a similar number coming from the clergy in the City of London. This was the greatest number of petitions to have been summoned by the Commons in the history of Parliament. Their requests ranged from confirmation of the acts against the Despensers and those in favor of Thomas of Lancaster to the reconfirmation of the Magna Carta. The Commons were concerned for the restoration of law and order, and one of their petitions called for the immediate appointment of wide-ranging keepers of the peace who could personally put men on trial. Their request was agreed by the King's Council. The return to normal parliamentary business demonstrated, it was hoped, both the regime's legitimacy and its ability to repair the injustices of the previous reign. Most of the petitions were accepted, resulting in 17 statute articles, which indicates how keen Isabella and Mortimer were to placate the Commons. When Parliament finally dissolved on March 9th, 1327, it had been the second longest at 71 days of the century to date. Further notes Dodd, because of this, it was the only assembly in the late medieval period to outlive a king and see in his successor. Meanwhile, Edward II was still imprisoned at Kenilworth and was intended to stay there forever. Attempts to free him led to the transfer to the more secure Berkeley Castle in early April 1327. Plotting continued, and he was frequently moved to other places. Eventually being returned to Berkeley for good, Edward died there on the night of September 21st. Mark Omron described this as suspiciously timely for Mortimer, as Edward's almost certain murder removed a rival and a target for restoration for good. And then, you know, there are a couple other small sections here, but it's mostly about sort of scholars' take on the events and all that. And this episode is running a little bit long, so I will end it there. I hope you enjoyed learning about the Parliament of 1327. I certainly did. If you have any suggestions, questions, comments, you can always reach the show by emailing hello@sleepandrelaxasmr.com. You can always check out our website, sleepandrelaxasmr.com. Thanks as always for listening.